Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, and completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Trump troubles, economic plans, grounded Delta, Rio Olympics. Donald Trump brought charges of inviting violence against Hillary Clinton. He said he was misunderstood, misportrayed. Here he was on Tuesday.
If she gets to pick her judges, nothing you can do, folks. Although the Second Amendment people, maybe there is, I don't know.
Hillary Clinton pushed back in Des Moines.
Words matter, my friends. And if you are running to be president or you are president of the United States, words can have tremendous consequences.
And lots of gold in Rio. American swimmer Simone Manuel broke a record and made history last night.
It's definitely been a long journey these past 4 years, and I'm just so blessed to have a gold medal, and I'm just so blessed.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Megan Murphy of Bloomberg News, Catherine Rampell of The Washington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you make of the Trump and Clinton plans for the country's economy, of the Clinton Foundation emails with her State Department, of Trump's Second Amendment and Obama ISIS comments? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington, Megan Murphy. She's Washington Bureau Chief and Executive Editor at Bloomberg News. Megan, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on.
And from New York, Catherine Rampell, opinion writer at The Washington Post, covering economics, public policy, politics. Catherine, welcome.
Good to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Megan, and Catherine.
Let's go right back, first of all, to that moment in Wilmington, North Carolina. This was Tuesday. Here's the full clip of nominee Donald Trump warning supporters of the implications of Hillary Clinton being elected, her ability to choose Supreme Court justices, and then the Second Amendment people comment.
Hillary wants to essentially abolish the Second Amendment. By the way, and if she gets to pick her judges, nothing you can do, folks. Although the Second Amendment people, maybe there is, I don't know. But I'll tell you what, that will be a horrible day.
Megan Murphy, is that an invitation to violence? Something else? If we don't know, what's the significance of that?
And I think that comment, it's very difficult to read it any other way in terms of saying to people who are passionate about their support of gun rights that it's a call to arms. There's just no other way to put it. And I think there's many of us who've covered this campaign for so long have been surprised this week by the unwillingness to walk back those comments in some way or at least to clarify them. And it hits at a central conundrum for his campaign is it's not even so much what he says a lot of the time in terms of its outrageousness. It's that the very unpredictability of the comments and then the difficulty different factions of the campaign have in explaining them and putting them into context, you know, and trying to write this off as being taken out of context, a media firestorm, you just have a total sense of a lack of direction or any sort of cohesive thematic message coming through from the campaign right now. And I think that is its real difficulty. It's not the statements. It's just the lack of direction and focus.
Of course, the statements have their own weight as well. But Catherine Rampell, Donald Trump himself said, look, come on, of course this is not inciting violence. He was talking, I'll play the clip here with Fox News' Sean Hannity. This was the next day, and he said he was talking about the political power of Second Amendment supporters, not inciting violence against Hillary Clinton.
You look at the power they have in terms of votes, and that's what I was referring to. Obviously, that's what I was referring to, and everybody knows it.
Catherine, was it obvious that he was referring to the, yes, not inconsiderable power of the NRA and Second Amendment supporters? Was that obvious?
Hardly. I think Donald Trump at this point has lost the right to be given the benefit of the doubt when he says these very inflammatory comments. In the past, when he has made similar comments about all sorts of Variously outrageous things, including this week when he claimed that Obama was the founder of ISIS. Obama and Hillary Clinton, in fact, were the founders of ISIS. You know, he's walked them back and said, oh, I was being sarcastic or people misunderstood me. But, you know, he's a smart guy that he's done this so many times and has you know, put something out there to get a big cheer from the crowd and then to try to walk it back a little bit and say, oh, I didn't really mean that. I think at this point, very few people really believe that the more charitable interpretation is due.
Jack, let's listen to the ISIS comments. President Obama, founder of ISIS, Donald Trump claimed this week, and Hillary Clinton in there too, but here he was first at a rally, Fort Lauderdale, Florida, on Wednesday.
ISIS is honoring President Obama. He is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS.
Now, Jack, today, Donald Trump is tweeting, come on, this was sarcasm. This was sarcasm. Everybody can see that. But here he was on Thursday, radio interview, talk show host Hugh Hewitt. And Hewitt's trying to give him the opportunity to walk his comments back on President Obama and ISIS. And you can hear just how flatly Donald Trump will not, does not go there.
You said the president was the founder of ISIS. I know what you meant. You meant that he created the vacuum, he lost the peace.
No, I meant he's the founder of ISIS. I do. He was the most valuable player. I give him the most valuable player award. I give her, too, by the way.
Jack, I mean, can you say that and then come out with a tweet and say, come on, once again, just kidding, sarcasm, you're misportraying me?
In Trump world, you can, but in the world of, you know, real logic, real consequences, it's a nonsense. You know, 50 GOP national security experts came out with a letter this week predicting that Donald Trump would be, quote, the most reckless president in American history. And this week he showed he was the most reckless presidential candidate in history, giving credence to their claim. The New York Times notes these comments and says there's a disturbing scenario possible here that Trump has given up on winning. He understands that's not in the cards, but that he means to sort of pull down the system with him, a kind of Trumpian Götterdämmerung, and that he's appealing increasingly to mob sentiment in these crowds. And when you see the crowds, the Times last week did a sort of sound collage of crowds that drawn to Trump's rallies. You hear them, you know, kill her. Jail the bee, the N-word for the president. That's the mob mentality. And Rudolph Giuliani this week gave that more support when he said if Trump had come out flatly and said maybe someone could shoot Hillary, he said the crowd would have gone wild. Well, that's quite a comment.
Here's Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine. Of course, she came out this week against Donald Trump, saying she would not vote for him because he is, she said, unworthy of the presidency. Does not reflect, she said, historical Republican values. She talked with CNN about that on Tuesday.
He is antithetical to the values of the Republican Party. The Republican Party believes in the dignity and worth of the individual. Based on what I've seen Donald Trump say over and over and over again, that is not his style.
But Megan Murphy, as we know, Donald Trump won many primaries. What's the number? 38 that he always reminds us. And he is the fully officially nominated candidate of the Republican Party in this country. What's the press responsibility here when he's gone through the process and Americans have voted for him and many still come out to his rallies? And then you've got what may be even inciting to violence against an opponent.
I think that it's treading a very fine line here, and I think it's crucial to sort of set this into context, too, of when we have national polls. We did a poll this week which showed Hillary Clinton with a 6-point gap, and
that is actually lead, you mean by that?
Bloomberg did a poll, and the issue is that that's actually narrower than many people expected, and he did go through the process. He went up against some very, very credible opponents, and I think there is a danger here that is the media out of step with how ordinary voters are thinking and feeling, and I think you can also track that through the reaction on social, through the reaction we see at rallies, and it, when we go out to places like Wisconsin, to places like Pennsylvania, to places like Ohio, and we actually take the temperature, Trump is a very imperfect vehicle for the sentiment that so many people are feeling. They're disaffected. They're disenfranchised. They don't feel connected with the American political system writ large or Washington. Yes, he's the imperfect receptacle, but he is the receptacle they have. And I think we do not want to run the danger of becoming totally disconnected from this sentiment of angst, disenchantment, and a lack of tangible association with what we've always felt is the American dream in this country.
I mean, Catherine, what's the right way to approach coverage here when clearly he's tapping into real concerns, into real anger out there in a democracy that has every right to be expressed? I mean, you don't shout fire in a crowded theater, but people have to be able to stand up and say, we're not happy with the way things are, and here's the guy out front.
That's perfectly valid, and those of us in the press should acknowledge the extreme economic duress that many Americans have been experiencing, particularly older workers, let's say people who have been displaced from jobs in manufacturing or coal mining or other industries where the positions are not coming back. They have a perfect right and to feel that they have been aggrieved, that their livelihoods have been pulled from under them. And, you know, those of us in the press have probably not been paying enough attention to their struggles. That said, it's still our duty to analyze the candidate and whether he actually serves their interests. You know, if you look at Donald Trump's policies, he has these very glib solutions to the problems, the very real problems that many Americans are facing. He says he's going to bring back coal jobs through deregulation. If you look at why those jobs have disappeared, just as a for instance, mm-hmm. It's not primarily because of regulation. It's because of technological advancement that has made it easier to extract more coal with less labor, and more importantly, for natural gas, coal's biggest competitor, to get much cheaper. So, you know, I realize that there are a lot of people looking to Trump for solutions because their problems have been ignored for so long. I think the role of the press is to say, these are valid problems. Let's look at what solutions are available and whether the candidates are really offering them.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Big economic plans out there this week. More Trump shockers. We'll look at Delta, Baltimore, the Olympics. Megan Murphy is with us from Bloomberg News. Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post. Jack Beatty's here. You can join us as well. What do you think? How far is too far for a presidential candidate, Donald Trump, on the campaign trail? Who's got the right idea for American economics, Trump or Clinton? Who do you trust? Who do you believe? Are you unsettled, disgusted by the ties between the Clinton Foundation and Hillary Clinton's Department of State? Is that corruption, cronyism? Donald Trump very ready to point at that this week. Others as well. He called the press part of a rigged system and pounced on new revelations about emails between the Clinton Foundation and then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's staff.
It's really a shame that they can say whatever they want to say. They try and demean and defame. And then you look at what she's doing with her emails. 33,000 missing emails. Yeah, 33,000. Yeah.
Lock her up, lock her up is the chant. But he also was conceding publicly this week, the great winner, that he's got some challenges, having some trouble here. He was talking with a gathering of evangelical Christian pastors in Florida yesterday, urged evangelicals to vote. Polls show Clinton edging closer to Trump in Utah, where he can't afford to lose support of Christian conservatives. He sounded a kind of alarm with the pastors.
We're having a tremendous problem in Utah. Now, Utah is a different place, and I don't know if anybody—is anybody here from Utah? I mean, I didn't think so.
And not just there. Ohio, we need help. I mean, he's looking at what's happening in the polls. Liz, in North Andover, Massachusetts. Liz, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, my comment is again going back to that statement he made, that incredibly inflammatory statement about, if she gets to pick her judges, there's nothing you can do, folks. Mm-hmm. I think it's really important to, I know it seems like parsing his words a lot, but it's really important to note he's saying if she gets to pick her judges. She's only going to be doing that if she's elected.
Mm-hmm.
And if he was calling for people to use the ballot box and to vote, that's pointless after she's elected. I mean, I know it seems like a fine line, but I just,
So you're not buying the, it was a political exhortation comment.
I am not buying it. I am not buying that he was trying to get people to go to the ballot box, especially he's asking evangelicals to go vote, you just mentioned. Well, he knows how to do that. Now, the way that was phrased, that was incendiary, and I just can't believe that it's being allowed to stand.
Liz, we've got it. Let me play a little bit from Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House, fellow Republican, saying he interpreted it as more of a joke gone bad, he said.
It sounds like just a joke gone bad. I hope he clears it up very quickly. You should never joke about something like that.
But, of course, Hillary Clinton, a much more big hammer she brought down on this one here again in Iowa on Wednesday.
His casual inciting of violence. Every single one of these incidents shows us that Donald Trump simply does not have the temperament to be president and commander-in-chief of the United States.
Jack Beatty, what about the fallout from this? Yes, Hillary Clinton is up in the polls, but as you're hearing from your fellow guests, maybe not so dramatically up. Do you see real problems now unfolding for Donald Trump in the field?
Well, he seems to light a fire on himself every week. And the effect of this is we don't know. I mean, he proceeds on the assumption that all publicity is good. I think we may be at the end. We're testing that assumption. This isn't good publicity. And when you look at where his vote is strong, yes, it's strong among white working class voters, especially older voters. But when you look at college-educated women, a population carried almost by double digits, if not double digits, by Mitt Romney, Hillary Clinton is ahead by double digits among that population, and they turn out, whereas white working men roughly vote at 55% or did in 2012, college-educated women who were strongly for Hillary voted at 79%. So he's firing up that base every time, but perhaps and almost certainly alienating an even larger group of voters.
I saw somebody saying maybe the 19th Amendment people can do something about this, of course, referring to women getting the right to vote. There's Sam in Omaha, Nebraska. Sam, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say that I believe the media is way out of control and really just making up a lot of fake news about Trump to support Hillary Clinton. I think that Trump is putting forward concepts and issues that would help America, and Clinton and her cronyism is just using the media to manipulate the American public and think otherwise. So,
Sam, let me just ask you, because I'm wide open. I'm glad to hear what you're thinking, but what should the media do when a candidate appears to potentially be inciting violence against an opponent on the campaign trail, in the middle of a campaign?
Well, I believe any violence that's been incited really has been incited by the Democrats, much like when Hillary Clinton called out assassination attempts on Barack Obama, but the media really didn't do anything about it. And they forget.
I really don't know what you're talking about there, Sam.
I'm sorry?
Forgive me, but I'm not sure what you're referring to there in the instance of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama.
Well, there was an incident in which Hillary Clinton apologized and when she made reference to assassination and Barack Obama. And see, that's what I mean. The media has a real short attention span. They make up fake news about Trump, making a false claim that he called out assassination attempts on Hillary. That's just fake news, and the media made it up.
Well, I mean, what he said is not made up. I guess it's open to interpretation, but you've got a lot of people thinking, well, if it's that open to interpretation, what if somebody with a loose screw just acts on it?
Let's put it this way. Anybody that has any rational thinking concept if you're a rational thinker, Donald Trump was at a political rally. The purpose of a political rally is to gain voters. You call out special interest issues in which will attract voters to you because you're representing their cause.
But can you even play around with the idea of violence? Is that all right?
Excuse me?
Can you even play around with the idea of violence in that effort to bring out votes and support? Is that acceptable in a...
That's exactly what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Why would any reasonable person believe that's a call to violence when you could just as easily believe that's a call to motivate voters to get out there and vote for their Second Amendment rights?
If I may.
Yes. Is that Catherine or Megan?
Yeah, this is Catherine. Mm-hmm. I would add that Trump has been less ambiguous in his calls to violence against protesters. He has explicitly said, maybe it was a joke or otherwise, but it was a clear reference to violence, that if somebody makes a fuss at the campaign, you ought to punch him in the face. I'll pay your legal bills. He has literally said that multiple times in multiple ways. And again, maybe he was joking, but I don't think it was open to interpretation what the meaning of that particular joke was. So in that context, I don't think it's such a stretch to say these particular comments could be read that way by many of his supporters at his rallies who have heard more explicit calls to violence from their candidate.
I mean, I agree with this. It's a shame if interests, real fervently held interests of American voters don't get recognized because they become overshadowed by these things. But it seems a stretch to put that all on the media when the words are right there. But Sam, I appreciate your call very much. Mark in Appleton, Wisconsin. You're on, Mark.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think you've kind of ignored these comments about accusing President Obama of being the founder of ISIS. And Trump is now saying it was just sarcasm. There's a whole swath of the Republican Party that thinks that or are convinced that Obama is a Muslim. They've been attacked, you know, we have Trump being the birther and attacking his legitimacy as president. And in that context, this is incredibly dangerous words. I mean, basically, so even before he was president, you know, you had the terrorist fist bump and all this other nonsense about Obama. If you can just imagine if a Democratic presidential nominee had been accusing George W. Bush of being responsible for 9/11, and you have that fringe movement, what the outrage would have been. And I just think this is really outrageous. You're accusing the president of being a traitor, and it's being allowed, and I think that needs to be called out. And there is a lot of people who agree with that, and they cheer it, but that's pretty dangerous and pretty frightening.
Mark, I appreciate your call. I mean, there was a comment Sam talked about. This is back in 2008, Hillary Clinton in May of that year, you know, talking about things aren't over till they're over, I guess, saying that Bill Clinton hadn't wrapped things up until he won the California primary in the middle of June. She said, we all remember Bobby Kennedy was assassinated in June in California. She later apologized for that. Maybe a different amplitude on that, but you can hear Sam remembers it, and we'll go to it. Crystal in Iowa. Crystal, thank you for calling.
Thanks, Tom. I'm wanting to say today that I don't feel that Donald Trump should be considered as a candidate for president because he's threatened violence against another candidate. I think that should be an automatic disqualification for the office of president. I don't think cool heads are prevailing at all. And
are you a Clinton supporter, Crystal? May I ask, are you a Clinton supporter or something else?
I'm on the fence. I'm not really an anybody supporter right now. I don't really feel that anybody has earned my vote. When George W. Bush was president, I didn't agree with him or his policies, but I still called him the commander-in-chief. That office deserves some respect. And I don't feel that calling anybody other than president and whatever their last name is acceptable. I feel that we should stick to that. And I also feel that we shouldn't be threatening violence against others during the campaign because it only incites the people who are angry and upset and on the edge to do dumb things that they can't take back or to say words that they can't take back later.
Crystal, I appreciate your call. We're not going to solve that today, but I think we've given it a good look. I want to look at these economic plans, proposals that are out this week as well from both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Here was Donald Trump, this was Tuesday, saying that, among other things, he would jump in and really cut government regulation.
You cannot ever start a small business under the tremendous regulatory burden that you have today in our country. I'm going to end it. I am going to cut regulations massively. Massively.
There's Donald Trump. There's more to it. We'll look at it. Hillary Clinton in Warren, Michigan yesterday. He was in Detroit. She was in Warren saying, don't believe that Donald Trump is on the side of the little guy.
Now, there is a myth out there that he will stick it to the rich and powerful because somehow he's really on the side of the little guy. Don't believe it. Not when he pledges to rip up basic rules that hold corporations accountable.
Hillary Clinton on her economic plans and plenty of punches toward Donald Trump there as well. Megan Murphy, what did you think of these two speeches on the economy side by side this week? What are the visions there? How concrete do you see the planning and the thinking within these? How do they stack up?
What's really fascinating about the Trump plan that he put forward and what he'd already put some of the bones on, but just how straight out of the traditional Republican playbook it was in terms of Reagan-era supply-side economics, trickle-down theory. You know, we talk about taking the top rate of corporate tax down to 15%, simplifying the individual income structure and taking the top rate down, giving businesses a holiday for bringing back, you know, the trillions of income that rests in foreign shores because companies don't want to repatriate their income and pay what they call an uncompetitive rate of corporate tax. It really was a plan straight out of Paul Ryan's playbook. But yet, and yet, we still see businesses so reluctant to come out and support him because of the other side of the fence on Donald Trump. This was a very pro-business plan. This is a plan that would disproportionately benefit the wealthy, that actually left out a lot of the incentives that he had initially said he would outline for lower and middle income families in this country. And that's a vulnerability for him with Hillary Clinton. Now, what was interesting about Clinton's speech was instead of being a very economics-focused speech, it was a political speech. She didn't outline very many new ideas, but what she is going to seize on is this thread that you just played that clip that says that, look, this is a plan that does not actually do what he says it will do. It doesn't make your family's fortunes any greater. It doesn't give you that tangible promise of lifting you up. And on the converse, he'll say, my plan is going to rise all tides in the sense of getting growth back going by giving basically this money back to people and empowering businesses and empowering individuals. And that's a sort of straight up economic fight that's been playing out between the parties for decades.
Megan, you're with Bloomberg. You pay a lot of attention to business and economics. I mean, what about these two approaches? We've had low growth. Now, the unemployment is significantly down, though many are still on the sidelines. But we're talking down in the sometimes maybe 1% something growth here. Does the Trump approach, which is not exactly classic Republican because of the trade piece, which he pushes back on, but does it have a track record historically of producing higher growth? What about the Clinton approach, which is some kind of evolution of what we've seen under Barack Obama, I guess you'd describe it as?
Yeah, you're exactly right, and that the trade piece is sort of analogous and antithetical to the most sort of Republican plans. But look, we've seen recent experiments. We are in a low-growth environment. We're in a low-growth environment globally, and there's a raging debate on whether austerity plans that's been adopted in many Western democracies are the way forward, or whether this sort of doing an economic structure where you lower taxes, and hopefully that will boost revenue and boost growth coming through just a stimulation of business activity. We've seen these plans. Actually, we've seen tactics like this in states like Kansas, where taking these approaches but has actually backfired in the sense of you've seen revenues in that state dwindle precipitously, and it has been a failed experiment. It's an experiment that Republicans are very interested in rolling out across at the state level, and now we see it touted at the national level as well. The issue here that we face is that we have a very disruptive labor structure now in this country. Even when we have that headline rate of unemployment as low as it is, it's difficult to gauge how we boost participation in the labor force by women, mm-hmm. how we actually stimulate that next generation of growth. Is it through tech innovation? Is it through spending? Is it through a sort of moonshot on infrastructure? And those are the bigger, more sophisticated policy debates, which actually, just unfortunately, and some we're not really having in this campaign so far.
Catherine, Donald Trump saying it's time to borrow. That's not exactly classic Republican either. It's time to borrow big for infrastructure, I think he's saying this week.
It is and it isn't unusual to the Republican Party. Dick Cheney had basically said that deficits don't matter anymore in the past. So this is not exactly a new idea, and Trump, for that matter, needs to say that it's okay to borrow right now, given that his tax plan would cost trillions of dollars.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. With Rocket Mortgage, you can get approved for a mortgage in minutes using a phone or tablet. This completely online process uses cutting-edge technology to make getting a mortgage more convenient than ever before. Now you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button without the frustration of digging through stacks of financial documents. Info at quickenloans.com/onpoint, equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news, this week a 10-year-old boy died in a water slide accident in Kansas City. He was riding the world's tallest water slide, 17 stories high, designed for 2 to 3 riders to get onto a raft.
Kind of like something hit the slide. I turned around and the raft was coming on the second drop. Immediately after the raft, you see a body.
Brought tears to my eyes that someone else lost their child. That's my child's age that I'm sure they felt was safe.
A power outage, we're told, knocked out Delta's computer systems worldwide. At least half of all Delta Airlines flights delayed or canceled on Monday. They felt these delays well into the week. Delta passenger Ashley Roach was trying to fly from Kentucky to New York.
They offered us some bottled water. That was nice. I know it's not the gate attendant's fault, but I think the company could have done a better job of explaining to everybody who was waiting all over the country what was happening.
And all eyes were on Trump Tower in New York City on Wednesday when a man climbed up the side of the glass building using suction cups and a rope. He started on the 5th floor. Police captured him by the time he got to the 26th floor.
Hundreds of bystanders and pedestrians on the ground captivated. Even from inside the building, witnesses shocked.
Oh my goodness!
We're looking at a week in the news. Who's got the right ideas for the U.S. economy this week? What's it going to take to clean up Baltimore's police? Are you following that? Can you believe how screwed up Delta and its computers got this week? Does it make everything seem vulnerable? And what are you thinking on the Olympics, Michael Phelps, Simone Biles, Simone Manuel? What are you thinking on pot and the federal government's decision this week to keep it in the most dangerous category? We're with Megan Murphy of Bloomberg News, Catherine Rampell of The Washington Post, and Jack Beatty. Tommy is calling from Greenville, Alabama. Tommy, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I enjoy your program. I'm a conservative and have been for my entire adult life.
All right.
Now, Donald Trump, he really... comes off as a loose cannon, and you know, who knows what he would do if elected. But I heard your program with Gary Johnson the other day.
Mm-hmm, the Libertarian candidate for president.
Right, and it was a great interview, and I would encourage people just to at least give him a look, consider giving enough support to get into the debates so we can really hear some substance. Donald brings no substance.
Tommy, I appreciate your call. It was a pleasure talking with Gary Johnson. We had the chance to talk for an hour to him this week, Gary Johnson, and also with Green Party candidate Jill Stein. And you can link to those conversations at our website if you did not hear them. Catherine, can I come to you just on Gary Johnson for a minute? I mean, he's got the bigger showing in the polls at this point, some of them with him up around 10, 11% even. If he gets to 15, he's in the debates. Do you see that happening, and with what consequence for the general election? And for that matter, to Tommy's point, for the conversation we might have on the way to the general election.
My sense is if Donald Trump continues making these various unforced errors, comments about the president founding ISIS or whatever, or denigrating a Gold Star family, I think that that only helps third-party candidates and maybe Hillary Clinton as well. But Hillary Clinton also has very high unfavorables. So I think that there are a lot of voters who are listening to both of the major party candidates who are disgusted, who are turned off, who are looking for an out. That is another option in any case. There was actually a poll recently done in which survey respondents were asked, given the choice of Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, and Harambe, who you may remember is the unfortunately passed away gorilla from Astoria a month or so ago. Harambe did about as well as Gary Johnson, which makes me think that...
No disrespect to Governor Johnson, who I very much enjoyed talking with this week.
My point being that I think people don't actually know that much about Johnson at this stage in the game, but they are so desperate for a third option that they're willing to consider even... you know, a late gorilla, which sets up Mr. Johnson for you know, selling his case and saying he actually has some good ideas that the public should consider, that he's not just someone else. He's someone who has his own vision and his own ideas. And again, Trump's continued comments and Hillary Clinton's various scandals and things like that will only draw more attention to third-party candidates.
Jeff in Winchester, Virginia. Jeff, thank you for calling. You're on.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm an independent voter, and I've been voting that way since the mid-70s. I voted for Republicans and Democrats.
Okay.
The problem I have is I think the media has lost their credibility.
How so? Why so, Jeff? How so?
Election.
How so?
Well, you hear a lot of speculation. They put on all these so-called experts and panels and everything, and I just don't believe any of them knows what they're talking about. All they're doing is speculating about one issue or the other.
Well, what about when it comes down to something firm like the economy? What did you hear this week, Jeff?
Well, actually, I like Donald Trump, and you can thank CNN because they actually got me to go with Donald Trump.
By airing his speeches, or how so?
Well, first of all, you know, they talk about Trump attacking. Well, there's nobody attacks better than CNN.
So you're resenting the media's role and looking at Donald Trump's economic plan and feeling some warmth toward it. I appreciate your call, Jeff. I've got it. We're paying attention. It's not easy to make our way through the thicket this year because it's just wild and kind of off the charts of where we've been. But I appreciate your call. Jack, what are you thinking as you look at Donald Trump's economic plan this week? And what about concern among American voters who want something different, may not see as big a difference as they want in Hillary Clinton, and, you know, feel uncomfortable with the media calling out Trump because maybe, you know, he's the door to something different?
He certainly would be the door of something different, at least on the trade part. That's the one part of his economic speech that didn't seem to me to be a betrayal. Because the
betrayal of what, Jack?
Betrayal of his promise to the white working class voters. I mean, this economic plan is an Ayn Rand plan, or if not a Marie Antoinette plan. Eliminate the estate tax. Hillary Clinton estimates that if Trump is as rich as he claims, that would mean $4 billion for his children. Expand this pass-through deal where you're paying a 40%, instead of paying a 40% personal income tax rate, you'd pay at 15% for a limited liability corporation, something that would benefit as many as 200 of different Trump entities. His child care idea, you know,
deductible.
Well, taxed it, but only people that make out, you know, the file. Instead of expanding the child credit so that everybody could take it, there's just a feeling of it's being a scam, a betrayal of the voters whose hopes he has raised. Yes, he does have this trade idea, but what is that really? I think Michael Gerson is right. Basically, it's abandoning what Gerson calls the foundations of modern capitalism.
Michael Gerson, the former George Bush speechwriter?
Yes, tearing up the post-war trading system to produce what? A trade war that's going to benefit working people? And then this feeling of a scam, it just widens out when you look at what he's spending on ads. Hillary's campaign, $52 million thus far in presidential ads. Trump, zero.
Why is that a scam? A lot of people look at that and say, bravo, you know, just take your message right to the people.
Well, what's he doing with the money? I mean, and then you look at what's happening in the states. One office in Florida, one office in New Hampshire. Hillary has 11. No regional offices, no get-out-the-vote centers there.
What are you suggesting, Jack?
I'm suggesting that maybe a sort of subplot to this campaign is something Trump said years ago, which is, hey, I can run for president and make a profit out of it.
Boy, I don't know. Tim in Richmond, Kentucky. Tim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Two concerns I have. Neither candidate, neither party is addressing the debt and how we need to reduce that and get it to something manageable where it helps the economy be vibrant but not strangle us. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's appropriate for Hillary to attack people who achieve the American dream, saying, you got to stick it to somebody. So Bill Gates deserves to have it stuck to him because he's achieved the American dream.
You mean when she says, she, at the convention speech,
fair taxation,
yeah.
But to say to stick it to somebody, that's a professional of a candidate for the office of president.
Tim, I appreciate your call. Megan, what about when it comes to the budget and America's fiscal health? Is there one or the other of the candidates with a plan that is more responsible in that regard? What is responsibility right now? Donald Trump says interest rates are low. Let's borrow.
Yeah, I mean, we have this looming, actually, debt ceiling battle is going to come back next spring. Look, I mean, Catherine is exactly right in saying that Trump has shown no real method for paying for this plan that he's put forward. But the issue is, I don't think that American voters are all that interested right now in hearing those specifics. We have not, it's not this kind of campaign that we're running. So I don't know if responsible is really the way to even phrase it. This is a brutal knockdown, drag out campaign. It's going to be heavy on name calling politics and drag down through the mud. That's how it's going to be. That's how it's always been. I think that when we were looking at this, how we thought it might be, when we thought it might be a Jeb versus Hillary Clinton thing, that was going to be a very policy heavy election. That was going to be a real debate on the economic challenges facing this country, on the political challenges facing this country. That is not this campaign. And therefore, I think that in both respects, they have been let off the hook. You'd be, I have been so interested in Hillary Clinton's actually drifting away from policy specifics. Her speech this week was a perfect example of focusing so heavy again on the personality of this contest rather than the policy specifics. That is not her sweet spot. She is a policy wonk. You know, given the chance, she would rather expound at great detail on her policy for child care incentives, for college tuition credits, et cetera. So that is what is so interesting about this campaign, is how it has almost become divorced from policy specifics and how voters are going to respond to that in November.
It's unsettling. Catherine, what about this week, the new released State Department emails that show these communication between people at the State Department when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State and the Clinton Foundation, of course, her family's there in New York City. These are being presented as evidence of, at the very least, I guess, consideration of favors or expectation of favors. What do we see here? Is this corruption? Is it cronyism? Is it just bad judgment? Is it the way things work under the covers?
You know, it doesn't look good for her, certainly. There is sort of a whiff of pay for play. I don't actually know if that was the case in this situation. But again, you have to think about the context of her campaign, about her personality, about the Clintons in particular, going all the way back to Bill Clinton's presidency. There's always sort of been this whiff of pay for play, you know, renting out the Lincoln bedroom, things like that. And in that context, in that narrative, this looks very bad. I think in a vacuum, these emails are probably not exactly a smoking gun, but Americans are already so suspicious of cronyism, of her speeches on Wall Street, et cetera, that in that context, this does her certainly no favors.
Jack, it is pretty amazing that you had this huge foundation raising money all over the world at the same time that she was Secretary of State. You would think that you'd want an absolute wall between those if it were possible, given the huge potential for dark interpretation there.
Yes, and she pledged in 2009 that there would be such a wall when she took the office. It came out this morning that the FBI field office, one of them at least, wanted to go ahead with charges of public corruption against her on this question. And if Trump weren't destroying himself, as he seems to do regularly and making these scenes, this would be the main issue of the campaign. Can someone be trusted to run a government apart from her husband's, the interests of her husband's foundation? I mean, it just lowers your faith in Mrs. Clinton.
I don't want to get through this hour without hearing from the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division this week, talking about the police department in Baltimore. Lots of conversation about that since all of the police officers were let off without charges in the infamous case there. Vanita Gupta talked about it at a press conference on Wednesday. They looked into what's going on at that department and found, well, you can listen to her describe the ratio of stops and the racial profile.
African Americans accounted for 95% of the 410 individuals the police department stopped at least 10 times. Indeed, one African-American man was stopped 30 times in less than 4 years, with none of the stops resulting in a citation or a criminal charge.
I mean, a picture painted there of a police department is, I'm looking at one editorial here saying, beyond all bounds of constitutional justice in stopping and frisking and arresting residents without justification. Megan, how damning a picture of the Baltimore department?
Oh, incredibly damning. When you read the report, it's scathing just in terms of the outright discrimination, prejudice, not only against members of the African-American community, other minority communities, the LGBT community, et cetera. And what is so interesting, I think, that is going to be the import and the impact of this is going to be, how does it actually change policing behavior? Is it just going to be another blip in this, in what we've seen, these incidents across the nation, or is real meaningful change in how we look at dealing with policing communities and how the interaction police have, how to improve standards, how to prevent violent incidents from happening in the future? That, I think, is the hope that this report does spur meaningful change.
Jack, is this something productive coming out of the death of Freddie Gray that brought the Department of Justice's attention?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And it explains, as somebody pointed out, why Freddie Gray was arrested, because people arrested black people for minor matters, and why he ran, because that seems to be part of the picture, too, what happens to people. And you know, today, the op-ed piece in the Times from the Los Angeles Police Department basically saying, look, we had something similar to this in 2002, a big scandal. We were, you know, community and police were divided, and we've made an effort over the last years to heal that division. And they went on to talk about how they changed the culture, how the community policing and its cognate forms have worked and are working. So it says change can happen, even in something as sclerotic as a big city police department.
Big report on Baltimore right there. I don't want to go out of this week without celebrating the athletes who, despite what all the worries about how Rio would turn out, Zika and all the rest are down there, American athletes and all the rest. It is spectacular to watch them, whether it's Michael Phelps or we saw Simone Manuel or Simone Biles and all the others. Just incredible performances from athletes from around the world this week. We'll keep watching. Megan Murphy with Bloomberg News, Washington Bureau Chief and Executive Editor there. Thank you so much for being with us today, Megan.
Thanks so much.
Catherine Rempel, opinion writer at the Washington Post, with us from New York. Thank you, Catherine.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, great as always to have you, sir.
Thank you.
Listeners, check out the On Point newsletter, where we round up our best conversations from the week. You can also find exclusive commentary and behind-the-scenes extras. This week, we've got highlights from our interviews with two third-party candidates, Libertarian Gary Johnson and Green Party Jill Stein. Sign up at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.